recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks very much to Professor King for arranging this visit and to the organizations that helped to make the visit possible. I'll just say it's a pleasure to have all of you here. One of the real rewards and joys of my profession is that you get captive audiences from time to time to share about the things that you're really passionate about. And I don't know whether you're all here by your own volition or were required to come or are here for extra credit, but it is a pleasure to share some of these things with you, and I hope you find something meaningful in them. I'll be talking to you tonight, as the title suggests, about intellectual virtues and their importance to education. But before I do that, I want to share with you a little bit about where some of this material is coming from. I'm a philosopher, and I work in an area of philosophy called virtue epistemology. Epistemology is the philosophical study of knowledge and knowing. And virtue epistemology is an approach to epistemology that gives an important role, central role to reflection on intellectual character and intellectual virtues. Okay. Well, I've been writing about those topics for about 10 years, and at several points over the past decade, it's occurred to me how relevant the intellectual virtues are to thinking and learning and to education. But it's also struck me how infrequently I ever hear about intellectual character or intellectual virtues in the educational institutions that I've attended or worked at. So I've been thinking for a long time about getting an opportunity to apply some of the theory in epistemology to educational theory and practice. 4 years ago, almost to the day, a good friend of mine called me on a whim and said, "Hey, what would you think about starting a charter school? We've got lots of friends that could contribute to it in various ways. Our kids could go there." And I maybe foolishly said, "Hey, let's think about it, talk about it, and pursue it." We quickly got the idea that we could make the focus of the charter school growth in intellectual character virtues. The signature organizing principle of the school could be trying to foster growth in curiosity and open-mindedness and fair-mindedness and intellectual courage and intellectual rigor. Well, we researched for about 2 years and finally got to a point where we felt like it's really not worth moving forward. It's too risky. It's going to take up too much of our time and resources unless we have two things, unless we have some additional funding for the school. And then we also felt like we needed more time and thought and resources poured into thinking about what it would actually look like to educate for growth in intellectual virtues. That led me to apply for the grant that Professor King mentioned. The grant was awarded to us last spring. So I am presently directing the Intellectual Virtues and Education Project at Loyola Marymount University. And among the things that the project is doing are bringing together top scholars from philosophy and education and psychology to talk about what intellectual virtues are, why and how they matter to education, and what it would look like to educate for growth in intellectual virtues in a deliberate and explicit way. We're also bringing together teachers from several local schools to be exposed to learn about, and to give us a lot of feedback about the curriculum that's being developed. And then finally, the grant will give about $600,000 to a charter school that we're founding in our community, which is Long Beach, California. The Intellectual Virtues Academy will be a grade 6 through 8 public charter school that will open in the fall. The charter was just approved by the school district last month. And of course, the school will implement a lot of the resources that are produced by the scholars and by the teachers and so forth. So I mention all of that just to let you know that there is real world application to these things and that they have kind of real personal significance for me. And if you want to learn more about any of those projects or the school or whatever, please feel free to visit those websites. Okay, I want to start with a couple of questions. I'd like you to think about these questions with me. The first question is, what counts as academic success? Think about that for a minute. In the school that you're at now or in the schools that you've grown up attending, what is the measure of academic success? According to the standards of the school, when would someone know that they have succeeded or are succeeding? If you are like me, or the schools you've been to are like the ones that I've been to, you might say, well, good grades are a measure of success. If you go according to the recognized standards, good grades are the primary measure of academic success. Or if you're at a lower level of education, K through 12, say, you might think high test scores are the mark of academic success. Second question, what capacities or qualities are required for such success? Think about what you think academic success is and then ask yourself what qualities or capacities are required for achieving that kind of success. And again, if academic success is defined in terms of good grades or high test scores, your answer to the second question might be something like, well, I need an ability to memorize information really well. That's the key to success in college, the ability to memorize information as it was displayed on PowerPoint slides like these and give it back to the professor just as he or she presented it to me. It's one possibility. Or you might think if the goal is high test scores on standardized tests, maybe you need a certain kind of ability to reason in quantitative ways or what we often describe as a high IQ or raw intelligence. Now what I want you to think about is what picture of students that leaves us with. If we're thinking of academic success in those ways, and we're thinking of the qualities or capacities for success in the way that I just described, when we think of students then, or when students think of themselves, what do they see? Here's a nice depiction of what they see. This is from PhD Comics. I didn't know there was such a thing until someone sent me this particular comic. But I think much of education today is practiced as if students are essentially brains on sticks. Now, my goal tonight is to suggest an alternative. I'm going to argue for the thesis that education should aim in an explicit and deliberate and systematic way at fostering growth in intellectual virtues. I'll say more about what intellectual virtues are in just a minute, but the thesis I'm going to defend is that education should aim in an explicit and deliberate and systematic way at fostering growth in intellectual virtues. And like I said, I'm a philosopher, so I'm going to proceed in a philosophical fashion by first explaining some terms, secondly, giving you some reasons in support of my thesis, and third, by considering a couple of objections to my argument and then responding to those objections. So that's where we're headed. And I'll cover points 1 through 3 there by addressing a series of questions. First question is, what are intellectual virtues and how do they differ from related cognitive abilities and skills? Well, you can think of intellectual virtues as the personal qualities of a good thinker or a good learner. Dwell on that for a moment. The personal qualities of a good thinker or a learner. Behind that definition is the idea that part of thinking and learning is maybe kind of mechanical. Part of it is maybe just involves the functioning of certain hardwired abilities or capacities that we have. But that's not the whole of thinking and learning. That there's also a personal side to thinking and learning. And that personal side is the domain or the territory of intellectual virtues. Intellectual virtues include traits like curiosity or wonder, attentiveness, reflectiveness, intellectual autonomy, intellectual courage, open-mindedness, fair-mindedness, intellectual rigor, intellectual honesty, intellectual humility. Again, the character traits or personal qualities of a good thinker or a good learner. Now, this next point is probably the most theoretically challenging of any of all the points that I hope to make tonight. So if you can make it over the hump here, philosophically at least, you'll be in good shape. I want to say something about the structure of intellectual virtues. They have a two-part structure. All intellectual virtues have in common a certain motivational basis. They are all rooted in a love of or a commitment to or an enjoyment of knowledge and understanding. So someone whose character is marked by intellectual virtues cares about thinking and knowledge and learning. They want to expand their mind. They want to understand the world around them. But you might wonder, okay, if they all have that in common, then how does one intellectual virtue differ from another? And here the idea is that while all intellectual virtues have in common a similar motivational basis, each virtue has a unique or distinctive mindset or activity that distinguishes it from other virtues. The curious person is someone who is quick to ask why, quick to wonder. Someone who is struck by interesting, perplexing features of the world around her. An open-minded person is someone who is able to think outside the box, or someone who is able to set aside her own perspective and take up and give a serious consideration to an alternative, competing perspective. That's what's unique about open-mindedness. The intellectually courageous person is someone who is willing to persist in thinking or inquiring or holding to a particular belief, even when there is the threat of some sort of harm. So all the intellectual virtues are rooted, so to speak, in a love of knowledge and learning. They spring from that basic motivational basis, but then each one has its own distinctive emphasis or mindset or set of actions or abilities associated with it. So that's a little bit about what intellectual virtues are and how they're structured. Now let me offer a distinction between intellectual virtues on the one hand and cognitive faculties or abilities on the other hand. And here I have in mind things like your ability to see or your ability to memorize information or your ability to introspect, that is to be aware of and to know what you are thinking or feeling at any moment. Those are all, similarly, you could talk about raw intelligence. These are all parts of what we might describe as your intellectual hardware. It's important not to confuse cognitive faculties or abilities with intellectual character virtues. Why? Well, because excellent cognitive faculties and abilities are neither necessary nor sufficient for intellectual virtues. And to illustrate why that's the case, I can share with you about two students I had from a symbolic logic course that I recently taught. One's name was Shane, and one's name was Jacob. Shane was someone who did not have a natural gift for doing symbolic logic. I don't know about the philosophy majors here, but all of our majors need to take symbolic logic, And you can kind of put our majors into two categories: those for whom symbolic logic is brutally difficult, and those for whom it's a piece of cake. Shane definitely fell into the category of those for whom symbolic logic is really hard. It's very much like a math class or a geometry class. Okay. So he didn't have, I mean, he had the ability at one level, but he didn't have a strong ability to do logic. Okay. However, he was remarkably curious and reflective. He regularly asked really great outside-the-box questions about this principle or that principle. How could this principle in logic be true? Or how does this connect with something else that we talked about earlier in the semester? He was very reflective, very thoughtful. He also worked very hard. He ended up getting an A in the class because he, through hard work, learned to master the material. But it wasn't something that came easy to him. So that was an example of someone who was strong in intellectual virtues. He was curious. He was reflective. He was attentive. He had intellectual perseverance, intellectual courage. But he didn't have the gift of being able to do symbolic logic. Jacob, on the other hand, never really needed to come to class. The material from this class came to him very, very naturally, but he was lazy. He often didn't study for the exams and therefore didn't do as well on them as he could have, didn't often do the homework, was intellectually impatient with his peers who didn't understand the material. He was intellectually arrogant. Most of us have known people who are really smart, but who are intellectually arrogant or narrow-minded or what have you. There again, that illustrates how aptitude and hardwired ability is one thing, and good intellectual character is another. They can't totally be divorced. If I don't have any vision or memory or an ability to introspect or have no intelligence, then I'm probably not going to be able to get very far in my intellectual character development, and vice versa. But they're separable. Okay, so it's important. Don't confuse good intellectual character with smarts or with intelligence, as that's usually understood. Similarly, it's important to distinguish between intellectual virtues on the one hand and intellectual skills on the other. And by intellectual skills, I have in mind abilities to perform specific intellectual tasks. And these can be more or less specific: reading, writing, interpreting a poem, diagramming a sentence. Those are all cognitive or intellectual skills. They're closely related to intellectual virtues. A person who is open-minded will have the skill of perspective switching. A person who has the virtue of curiosity will be good at asking questions that lead to inquiry. So there's a close connection, but they aren't the same thing. And to illustrate this point, we can think in terms of what I'll describe as usage failures. Okay. We can imagine somebody, without any real difficulty, who is able to diagram sentences really effectively, but who in their grammar class refuses to do so out of laziness or stubbornness. Repeatedly refuses to do so. That seems entirely possible, right? You can have a skill and not use it even when it's called for. And you can do that regularly. Intellectual virtues are different. Suppose I have the ability to switch perspectives. I could take up your perspective if I wanted to and give it a fair hearing. Suppose I have that ability, but I routinely fail to use it when it's called for. When I'm in discussion with other people about politics or religion or whatever, I refuse to take up their perspective and consider things from their point of view. While I might have the skill of perspective switching, I wouldn't be open-minded, would I? So the possession of intellectual virtues is not consistent with a lot of usage failures. But a possession of intellectual skills is consistent with usage failures. So that illustrates a difference between intellectual skills and intellectual virtues. And as you're probably thinking right now, intellectual virtues involve something else beyond skills. They involve a kind of proper motivation and a readiness to use those skills when they're called for. So they're related, but they're different. Okay, so the first conclusion we can draw here is that intellectual virtues are the personal qualities required for good thinking and learning. They are rooted in a love of knowledge, and they are related to, but different from, cognitive faculties and intellectual skills. Next question. Why should education aim at fostering intellectual virtues? Hopefully you now have at least a rough idea of what I'm talking about when I talk about intellectual character, intellectual virtues. Now let's think together about why education should aim at trying to foster growth in these qualities that we've been discussing. I'm going to give you three reasons. The first reason is pretty straightforward. By thinking of intellectual virtues as an educational goal, we have a way of thickening and therefore of better achieving certain familiar, good, but kind of slippery and nebulous educational goals. How many of you have ever heard the idea that at your school, they're all about teaching a love of learning or lifelong learning? Really? That's not many hands. Maybe I've gone to unusual schools where there's usually quite a bit of talk about fostering lifelong learning. That's a good goal. It's a very important goal. But what exactly is lifelong learning, or what exactly is the lifelong learner? What are the basic attitudes, abilities, emotions, beliefs, feelings of a lifelong learner? That's not very often spelled out or reflected in curriculum or instruction. Okay. Well, by thinking of education in terms of intellectual virtues, we have a way of unpacking and of better aiming at and achieving that goal and several related goals. Some other goals that come to mind that I won't elaborate on now but that are equally relevant are critical thinking. Or at my university, one of the central goals is education of the whole person. Important goals, but that aren't often spelled out in a lot of detail. Okay, well, the important thing to note here is that intellectual virtues simply are the character traits of a lifelong learner. A lifelong learner is someone who's inquisitive. A lifelong learner is someone who is committed to learning and growing in knowledge and understanding. They're open-minded, they're fair-minded, they're also intellectually demanding and rigorous and persevering. Intellectual character virtues are the substance of what it means to be a lifelong learner. Okay. What that means is that they provide a more concrete, they're the substance of it, right? So they provide a more rich and descriptive way of understanding what lifelong learning is. And so by adopting intellectual character growth or the fostering of intellectual virtues as an important goal, we can, by that means, do a better job of creating lifelong learners. If you want to be a lifelong learner, maybe a good, more immediate goal is to grow in these qualities. It gives you something more concrete, doesn't it? Curiosity, open-mindedness, intellectual courage. There's a richness and substance there that there isn't, maybe, to this idea of being a lifelong learner or being a critical thinker. So one reason to treat or think of fostering intellectual virtues as an important educational goal is that it allows us to thicken or enrich our understanding of and therefore to better achieve certain familiar but kind of slippery or nebulous educational goals. And a similar point, as I've suggested, can be applied to critical thinking and education of the whole person. Second, educating for intellectual virtues provides a way of making education both rigorous and personal. And to unpack what I mean here, let me quickly review with you an important point in a book by the great American philosopher and educational theorist John Dewey. In a book called The Curriculum and the Child, Dewey draws this distinction between two different ways of thinking about how students should be taught, how children should be taught, and what they should be taught. And he says at one end of the kind of spectrum is this idea that students need to learn bodies of knowledge as those bodies of knowledge have been formulated by experts and academics throughout the ages. So there are academic disciplines out there, and students need to, their job and the job of teachers is to help students to master those bodies of knowledge. Students need to conform their minds to the knowledge that is out there and the categories that are out there, because in doing so, they are coming to understand reality as it is. There's something right about that. If through education we want to understand the world, then there's a sense in which we should feel some obligation to conform our minds and categories to the way things are. Then there's the other end of the spectrum, in Dewey's view, which says no, if you don't want to extinguish a child's love of learning, what you need to do is start with the interests, the passions, and other elements of the child's psychology, and let those facts about the child's psychology dictate what the child learns and how they learn it. Well, as you can imagine in this book, Dewey goes on to say, you know, these are two important points, and education needs to kind of connect both of these. And my concern isn't so much with his answer to how to thread the needle here, but rather with the basic dichotomy. I'm suggesting that the dichotomy here is a dichotomy between wanting to make education rigorous on the one hand. We hear a lot about that in schools at various levels today. With the problem of grade inflation, we need to have a return to academic rigor. And that's a genuine value. But then we're also concerned today with making education personal and making it relatable, attending to the actual psychology and personal development of students. Okay, so a good educational theory, right, should be one that is both, or a good educational framework should be one that is both rigorous and personal. So I think the second reason to embrace an intellectual virtues educational framework is that it provides a way, a very natural way, of making education both rigorous and personal, and here's why. Someone with the traits that we're talking about does not aim at the short-term memorization of isolated facts or bits of information. That shouldn't surprise you. Someone with the traits that we're discussing wants understanding. They want to know how and why. They desire what philosophers and philosophers of science call explanatory understanding. They don't want to just memorize. They aren't interested in trivia. They want to understand important knowledge. Is a rich explanatory understanding of important knowledge an easy thing to come by? No. It's hard. It takes time. It takes effort. It makes demands on your will and on your choices and on your commitment, on your agency and on your character. Okay. In that sense, then, if we are educating for intellectual virtues, or if as students you desire to grow in intellectual virtues, then you are going to approach your studies in a rigorous way. Or if I'm teaching because I want my students to grow in intellectual virtues, the content of my courses is going to be academically rigorous, because those courses are going to be aimed at genuine understanding, not the ability to just memorize and spit back information. Okay. So an intellectual virtues approach to education will necessarily be rigorous. But it will be equally personal. Why? Because if I'm teaching for intellectual virtues, my fundamental concern is with the personal qualities that my students are developing. I'm concerned with their basic beliefs and desires and feelings about knowledge and thinking and learning. I'm trying to thoughtfully, carefully cultivate their relationship to learning. That's a very, very personal enterprise. So if I'm educating for intellectual virtues, I'm going to have a high standard for my students, but I'm going to be very attentive to their progress and their development on the way to meeting that standard. And my ultimate concern is really going to be with how they develop as persons. So by thinking of education as aiming, not exclusively, but as thinking of growth in intellectual virtues as an important educational aim, I am automatically going to be teaching for rigor and teaching in a way that is intimate and personal. So that's another, you know, thing in favor of, or argument in favor of teaching for intellectual virtues. Third argument. Educating for intellectual virtues provides a way of introducing meaning and purpose to teaching and learning. And I'll just mention as kind of an aside that this is a point, this isn't a point that I came to by way of pure philosophical armchair reflection. This is a point or an argument that I came to through conversations with teachers in this, as part of this grant project, who had begun experimenting in their teaching with educating for intellectual virtues. And one of the things they said over and over was, thinking of education in these terms, engaging with my students with this goal in mind, brings meaning and purpose. A number of them used the word hope to what they were doing in the classroom. Okay, so this is coming from real life teachers, as opposed to, you know, people like me. I am a real-life teacher as well, but it's not in some richer, fuller sense, I guess. In the background is the principle here that a good educational goal will make the value of education evident to teachers and students. Can you buy that? That a good educational goal, when properly pursued, will make the value of education evident to teachers and students. Now, to see the work that a principle might like this, that a principle like this might do, let's consider as a test case the kind of implicit idea that the goal of education is good grades or high test scores. Let's go with high test. Let's go with high scores on standardized tests for a minute. Suppose that that's the implicit goal of the high school that you're in or that you're teaching in, right? If that's the goal, is that something that as a teacher or a student is going to get you out of bed in the morning? Teachers are led to the teaching profession because they think that teaching is meaningful, valuable work. When students are motivated intrinsically, when students experience a love of learning, They experience that because they sense that, wow, there is something good and valuable about pursuing knowledge and about thinking and expanding their minds. But if we take as our goal the getting high scores on standardized tests or scoring high on true, false, or multiple choice exams or exams that don't require you to do anything more than just, again, regurgitate information that was presented to you in class, that's not going to make for a very meaningful experience for teachers, and it's not going to make for a very meaningful experience for students either. And it might make students who are, say, paying $40,000 to $50,000 a year for their education begin to wonder, is it worth it? Well, if that's the goal, I think they're reasonable to ask the question. So you can see where this is headed. If you think of the goal of teaching as helping my students grow in some of these qualities, that could get you out of bed in the morning. Because again, if I'm educating in that way, I am trying to change who my students are. I'm trying to shape some of their fundamental beliefs and attitudes and feelings about thinking and knowledge and learning. I'm helping them become more inquisitive, become more intellectually courageous, become more curious and open-minded. That's meaningful from the standpoint of the teacher. But of course, it's also, I would think, meaningful from the standpoint of the student as well. Wouldn't you rather be in a learning environment where the teacher is concerned with who you are as a person, with your growth in some of these qualities? I think most of us would say yes. And I think part of that is because that sort of enterprise can happen only where there are good, trusting, caring relationships between the students and between the teacher and the students. So to be in an environment that's about educating for intellectual virtues is to be in a trusting and caring environment. It's to feel as a student like your teacher is really interested in who you are. They're not viewing you as a mere brain on a stick. Okay. So, and I'll add to this as well. There is kind of an instrumental dimension to this. If you are being educated for growth in intellectual virtues, you are being educated to think well. And thinking well is a good thing in itself, but it's also good for other reasons. You've probably heard that employers today are looking for graduates with what they call soft skills. Right? With our technology-based economy, things are changing. The skills required for being a contributor to our economy change rapidly. And so what a lot of employers are looking for are certain kind of fundamental skills that will apply no matter what the dominant technology is. And some of these soft skills just are intellectual virtues. They include open-mindedness. They include perseverance and thinking. They include curiosity. So if you're being educated for intellectual virtues, you're being educated for, at some level, success in the workplace. Most of you know that living well and having a good life requires making tough choices. And choosing well requires being able to think through the alternatives and to assess pros and cons, to deliberate well. Once again, if you're being educated for intellectual virtues, then you are being educated to think and deliberate well. So there's a great deal of value to education if you think of it as aiming substantially, and again, I don't mean to say exclusively, but substantially at growth in these traits or qualities. Okay, so those are three arguments. By way of conclusion, and don't get too excited, I'm not done yet. I need to consider a couple objections, but I can move a little bit more quickly. Educating for intellectual virtues provides a way of, one, thickening some familiar but nebulous educational goals, two, making education rigorous and personal, and three, introducing meaning and purpose to teaching and learning. So those are the three reasons I've given for thinking that education should aim at intellectual character growth. So some objections and replies. First, someone might think, this all sounds good and fine in principle, but think about all the things that teachers are required to do today and are responsible for. How can they possibly do everything they're required to do and also teach for growth and intellectual character? It might be a great idea, but it's not practically feasible. That's a very reasonable worry or question to have. But I think it's misplaced, and here's why. I think behind that worry is a lack of a distinction between what I'll call traditional character education and intellectual character education. Okay? Traditionally, when theorists have talked about character education, they've talked about education that's aimed at fostering certain moral and civic virtues. Things like compassion or kindness or respect or responsibility or civility or tolerance. Those are all great qualities, and I personally think that education should have an influence on the development of students in those different ways. But if that's our concern with teaching kindness or compassion or respect or responsibility, that might require time that a lot of teachers don't have. But that's not how intellectual character education works. Here's the thing for you to see. I mean, fostering intellectual virtues is surely a complex process that needs to be addressed at many different levels and in many different ways. But one of the things that it will involve is giving students an opportunity to practice intellectual virtues. Many of you have probably studied Aristotle, and he says, look, the way that you develop virtues is just like the way that a carpenter becomes a good carpenter. How? Through practice. You become a good carpenter through practicing carpentry well. Similarly, he'd say, you become a courageous person by performing courageous acts. Well, what are the actions associated with intellectual virtues? They're a matter of thinking, reasoning, listening, reading, interpreting, and analyzing in good, honest, curious, tenacious, courageous ways. What I want you to see is that, therefore, helping students grow in intellectual virtues happens through their thinking about math or about science or about literature or about history. It comes with how they think. Okay? So if I want to, the result is that educating for intellectual virtues you don't have to choose between, do I teach academic content and standards or do I teach intellectual virtues? No, I teach intellectual virtues by teaching math in a certain way or by teaching history in a certain way, or philosophy, or literature, or what have you. So educating for intellectual virtues is largely, not entirely, but it's largely a matter of how one teaches, not what one teaches. It's not primarily a separate curriculum. It's rather taking the academic content that is there, packaging it in a certain way, and approaching or teaching it in a certain way. Okay? Very good. So the second and final objection would be as follows. Someone might say, look, okay, you're right. A good education will make students more intellectually virtuous. But that doesn't mean that we should treat intellectual virtues as an explicit educational goal. Right? Good education, you might say, always has and always will produce students that are more curious and open and fair-minded and intellectually honest. So you might think, why does this really need to be explicit? In fact, you might think that by making it explicit, we're going to, you'd almost cheapen it, right? By hitting students over the head with the message to be intellectually courageous or be curious, you might think that that could actually undermine the motivation that students have for growing in or pursuing these qualities. Now, the truth is, I think there is that's at least partially valid concern. Okay, so I do think that it's important to avoid trivializing or oversaturating students with these terms and concepts and ideas if our goal is really to help them grow in these goals. And in fact, if you read some books about character education, you know, there are, you read about schools that have, you know, be courageous bracelets and t-shirts and bulletin boards, and some of it seems over the top, and I can imagine students there feeling like, I don't want to hear anything else about these qualities, right? Their schools have tried to make these qualities cool, and as soon as you try to make something cool, right, I mean, you've failed. So I do think there's a legitimate concern, and I think that the most effective approach will be a subtle one. And here's the model that I want to leave you with for how to foster how intellectual character growth can be fostered. And I think of this as kind of a middle ground between the oversaturation, hitting people over the head, trivialization pursuit on the approach on the one hand, and then the purely indirect approach on the other. The idea is that the most effective way, and there is a fair amount of research on this, even in the domain of intellectual character, but that the most effective way of promoting intellectual virtues is through a process of enculturation. And the basic idea is that you identify what counts as a classroom culture, or if you're a teacher, you say, okay, what are the kind of cultural elements of my classroom? What are the norms? What are the values? What are the rituals, the routines, the expectations? And you take each of those variables, and you point them toward the goal of nurturing these qualities. That doesn't mean that you label all these variables, you give them all virtue labels or terms. Some of this will be implicit or indirect. And I'll quickly run through what that might look like. So, and this is kind of an ideal, and not every teacher or school has an opportunity to realize every one of these steps or points. But here again, there is a good bit of research that suggests the real importance of an institutional culture that values intellectual character growth. So you'd want to have an institutional culture that defines itself and thinks of itself as a place that it values and is about promoting growth in intellectual virtues. So you want some of these values and some of these terms to enter into the institution's self-understanding. You want it to be reflected in how the institution programs and how they allocate their resources. So an institution that's about promoting intellectual character would be one that brings in speakers to talk about intellectual character and intellectual virtues. So where's the dean again? Right. That's a good sign. Lack of intellectual humility. Check. But a concern with trying to educate for these qualities will be reflected in the programs and the way that resources are allocated. It'll also be reflected in curriculum. And here I think a lot of the substance of what we're talking about would be indirect. So a curriculum that promotes intellectual character growth would be one that aims for understanding as opposed to mere memorization. Okay. It would be one that places value on intrinsic motivation in learning and so forth. So you want a culture that supports intellectual character growth. Secondly, the suggestion is, again, there's a lot of research on this, that you do need to give teachers and students the tools with which to think about these things and to talk about these things. So if I'm educating for intellectual virtues, and I do this in the classes that I teach, I try to just familiarize my students with the language and with some of the basic concepts. And when I'm teaching, I try to invoke those concepts in a very natural way. I mean, I might just say, look, this next unit is going to be extremely intellectually challenging. You're going to have to really try to be open-minded about some of the ideas that we're considering and working some of the language and concepts into what's being discussed and in how you're approaching the subject matter. Similarly, from a teacher's standpoint, recognizing intellectually virtuous actions in students when they come up, when they arise. So I've had lots of students who have done remarkable things in class, and because of how the class was set up, I was able to say, look at what just happened. Look at how you responded to this other person. That's a perfect example of open-mindedness or fair-mindedness. They get it, and because they have the background knowledge, there's been some direct instruction, they see the value and substance of it as well. A third part of educating for intellectual virtues will involve a lot of self-reflection and self-assessment. So it's important, if we want to grow in these traits, that we know what they are and why they're valuable, but that we also know ourselves in relation to them. That by itself is a big, an important milestone, an important goal, just knowing what your own intellectual character strengths and weaknesses are. So if we're educating for intellectual virtues, we'll be helping students acquire that kind of understanding, and that can come through lots of different ways and exercises. Fourth, working the concepts and language into the educational process, that can come through instruction. It can also come through how you set up the objectives for your course. Is my course designed in such a way that my students are forced to really aim for and demonstrate understanding? We can work some of these concepts into rubrics. Many of us already do. Many of your teachers already do. When they ask for a careful or thorough argument or explanation in your exams or on a paper, right? So it's easy to work some of the language of this into the expectations and rubrics for the courses that we teach or the courses that you're taking. A lot more that could be said about that, but I'll move on because I think this final point is as important as any of the others, which is that if I'm wanting to educate for intellectual virtues, then more than anything, I have to model those traits for my students. All of us know that we pursue the course that we do in life, that we fashion ourselves often in light of who we admire. And it's people or characters that we admire that shape the course of our lives and that shape the people that we become. Right? And hopefully you know from experience that a teacher who pursues his or her subject matter with passion and curiosity and open-mindedness and reflection and carefulness and thoroughness can be a really moving invitation to the life of the mind. So I think that, again, from a teaching standpoint, it's difficult to overestimate the importance of an authentic modeling of these traits. And that doesn't need to be done through teaching the traits at all. It just happens through modeling it. But the bigger picture here would be one where, again, there are lots of different things that go on in the class, some that explicitly mention virtues, some that don't. But all these different things that are complementary to each other, that are aimed at helping teachers and students grow in these qualities. So here, the conclusion is that intellectual virtues can be fostered through a process of enculturation, and this process is consistent with a strong academic focus. You don't have to choose between educating for intellectual character growth on the one hand and educating for academic content on the other. And I'll close with this nice quote, and I tried to track down where in Dostoevsky it comes from. If someone knows, they can tell me. It's probably a character. I can guess about who it might be, but it's a lovely quote that fits with what we're talking about. It's not the brains that matter most, but that which guides them. Character, the heart, generous qualities, progressive ideas. Here the focus has been on the idea that, look, you should think of yourselves And those of us that are teachers should think of our students not as brains on sticks, but as, yes, beings that have brains, but brains that are guided and guided well or poorly by the underlying character or heart behind them. Thanks very much.